Chapter 11 Continued. As they came into the castle, they spotted Cormac MacLagan entering the great hall. It took him 2 attempts to get through the doors. He ricocheted off the frame on the first attempt. Ron merely guffawed gloatingly and strode off into the hall after him, but Harry caught Hermione's arm and held her back. "What?" said Hermione defensively. "If you ask me," said Harry quietly, "MacLagan looks like he was confounded, and he was standing right in front of where you were sitting." Hermione blushed. "Oh, all right then, I did it," she whispered. "But you should have heard the way he was talking about Ron and Ginny. Anyway, he's got a nasty temper. You saw how he reacted when he didn't get in. You wouldn't have wanted someone like that on the team."
"No," said Harry. "No, I suppose that's true. But wasn't that dishonest, Hermione? I mean, you're a prefect, aren't you?"
"Oh, be quiet," she snapped, as he smirked.
"What are you two doing?" demanded Ron, reappearing in the doorway to the great hall and looking suspicious.
"Nothing," said Harry and Hermione together, and they hurried after Ron.
The smell of roast beef made Harry's stomach ache with hunger, but they had barely taken 3 steps towards the Gryffindor table when Professor Slughorn appeared in front of them, blocking their path.
"Harry, Harry, just the man I was hoping to see," he boomed genially, twiddling the ends of his walrus moustache and puffing out his enormous belly. "I was hoping to catch you before dinner. What do you say to a spot of supper tonight in my rooms instead? We're having a little party, just a few rising stars. I've got MacLagan coming, and Zabini, the charming Melinda Bobbin, I don't know whether you know her. Her family owns a large chain of apothecaries. And, of course, I hope very much that Miss Granger will favour me by coming too."
Slughorn made Hermione a little bow as he finished speaking. It was as though Ron was not present. Slughorn did not so much as look at him.
"I can't come, Professor," said Harry at once. "I've got a detention with Professor Snape."
"Oh, dear," said Slughorn, his face falling comically. "Dear, dear, I was counting on you, Harry. Well, now, I'll just have to have a word with Severus and explain the situation. I'm sure I'll be able to persuade him to postpone your detention. Yes, I'll see you both later."
He bustled away out of the hall.
"He's got no chance of persuading Snape," said Harry, the moment Slughorn was out of earshot. "This detention's already been postponed once. Snape did it for Dumbledore, but he won't do it for anyone else."
"Oh, I wish you could come. I don't want to go on my own," said Hermione anxiously.
Harry knew that she was thinking about MacLagan.
"I doubt you'll be alone. Ginny'll probably be invited," snapped Ron, who did not seem to have taken kindly to being ignored by Slughorn.
After dinner, they made their way back to Gryffindor Tower. The common room was very crowded, as most people had finished dinner by now, but they managed to find a free table and sat down. Ron, who had been in a bad mood ever since the encounter with Slughorn, folded his arms and frowned at the ceiling. Hermione reached out for a copy of the Evening Prophet, which somebody had left abandoned on a chair.
"Anything new?" said Harry.
"Not really."
Hermione had opened the newspaper and was scanning the inside pages.
"Oh, look, your dad's in here, Ron. Oh, he's all right," she added quickly, for Ron had looked round in alarm. "It just says he's been to visit the Malfoys' house. This second search of the Death Eater's residence does not seem to have yielded any results. Arthur Weasley, of the Office for the Detection and Confiscation of Counterfeit Defensive Spells and Protective Objects, said that his team had been acting upon a confidential tip-off."
"Yeah, mine," said Harry. "I told him at King's Cross about Malfoy and that thing he was trying to get Borgin to fix."
"Well, if it's not at their house, he must have brought whatever it is to Hogwarts with him." "But how can he have done, Harry?" said Hermione, putting down the newspaper with a surprised look. "We were all searched when we arrived, weren't we?"
"Were you?" said Harry, taken aback. "I wasn't." "Oh, no, of course you weren't. I forgot you were late. Well, Filch ran over all of us with secrecy sensors when we got into the entrance hall. Any dark object would have been found. I know for a fact Crabbe had a shrunken head confiscated. So, you see, Malfoy can't have brought in anything dangerous." Momentarily stymied, Harry watched Ginny Weasley playing with Arnold the Pygmy Puff for a while before seeing a way around this objection. "Someone sent it to him by owl, then," he said. "His mother or someone." "All the owls are being checked, too," said Hermione. "Filch told us so when he was jabbing those secrecy sensors everywhere he could reach." Really stumped this time, Harry found nothing else to say. There did not seem to be any way Malfoy could have brought a dangerous or dark object into the school. He looked hopefully at Ron, who was sitting with his arms folded, staring over at Lavender Brown. "Can you think of any way Malfoy—" "Oh, drop it, Harry," said Ron. "Listen, it's not my fault Slughorn invited Hermione and me to his stupid party. Neither of us wanted to go, you know," said Harry, firing up. "Well, as I'm not invited to any parties," said Ron, getting to his feet again, "I think I'll go to bed." He stomped off towards the door to the boys' dormitories, leaving Harry and Hermione staring after him. "Harry," said the new chaser, Demelza Robbins, appearing suddenly at his shoulder. "I've got a message for you." "From Professor Slughorn?" asked Harry, sitting up hopefully. "No, from Professor Snape," said Demelza. Harry's heart sank. "He says you're to come to his office at 8:30 tonight to do your detention, no matter how many party invitations you've received. And he wanted you to know you'll be sorting out rotten flobberworms from good ones to use in potions. And he says there's no need to bring protective gloves." "Right," said Harry grimly. "Thanks a lot, Demelza." Chapter 12. Silver and Opals. Where was Dumbledore, and what was he doing? Harry caught sight of the headmaster only twice over the next few weeks. He rarely appeared at meals any more, and Harry was sure Hermione was right in thinking that he was leaving the school for days at a time. Had Dumbledore forgotten the lessons he was supposed to be giving Harry? Dumbledore had said that the lessons were leading to something to do with the prophecy. Harry had felt bolstered, comforted, and now he felt slightly abandoned. Halfway through October came their first trip of the term to Hogsmeade. Harry had wondered whether these trips would still be allowed, given the increasingly tight security measures around the school, but was pleased to know that they were going ahead. It was always good to get out of the castle grounds for a few hours. Harry woke early on the morning of the trip, which was proving stormy, and whiled away the time until breakfast by reading his copy of Advanced Potion Making. He did not usually lie in bed reading his textbooks. That sort of behaviour, as Ron rightly said, was indecent in anybody except Hermione, who was simply weird that way. Harry felt, however, that the Half-Blood Prince's copy of Advanced Potion Making hardly qualified as a textbook. The more Harry pored over the book, the more he realized how much was in there. Not only the handy hints and shortcuts on potions that were earning him such a glowing reputation with Slughorn, but also the imaginative little jinxes and hexes scribbled in the margins, which Harry was sure, judging by the crossings out and revisions, that the prince had invented himself. Harry had already attempted a few of the prince's self-invented spells. There had been a hex that caused toenails to grow alarmingly fast. He had tried this on Crabbe in the corridor, with very entertaining results. A jinx that glued the tongue to the roof of the mouth, which he had twice used, to general applause, on an unsuspecting Argus Filch, and, perhaps most useful of all, Muffliato, a spell that filled the ears of anyone nearby with an unidentifiable buzzing, so that lengthy conversations could be held in class without being overheard. The only person who did not find these charms amusing was Hermione, who maintained a rigidly disapproving expression throughout and refused to talk at all if Harry had used the Muffliato spell on anyone in the vicinity. Sitting up in bed, Harry turned the book sideways so as to examine more closely the scribbled instructions for a spell that seemed to have caused the prince some trouble. There were many crossings out and alterations, but finally, crammed into a corner of the page, the scribble, Levicorpus, n-vble. While the wind and sleet pounded relentlessly on the windows and Neville snored loudly, Harry stared at the letters in brackets. N-vble. That had to mean non-verbal. Harry rather doubted he would be able to bring off this particular spell. He was still having difficulty with non-verbal spells, something Snape had been quick to comment on in every DADA class. On the other hand, the prince had proved a much more effective teacher than Snape so far. Pointing his wand at nothing in particular, he gave it an upward flick and said, Levicorpus, inside his head.
Ah!
There was a flash of light, and the room was full of voices. Everyone had woken up as Ron had let out a yell. Harry sent advanced potion-making flying in panic. Ron was dangling upside down in mid-air, as though an invisible hook had hoisted him up by the ankle. Sorry, yelled Harry, as Dean and Seamus roared with laughter, and Neville picked himself up from the floor, having fallen out of bed. Hang on, I'll let you down. He groped for the potion book and riffled through it in a panic, trying to find the right page. At last he located it and deciphered one cramped word underneath the spell. Praying that this was the counter-jinx, Harry thought, Libera Corpus, with all his might. There was another flash of light, and Ron fell in a heap onto his mattress. Sorry, repeated Harry weakly, while Dean and Seamus continued to roar with laughter. Tomorrow, said Ron in a muffled voice, I'd rather you set the alarm clock. By the time they had got dressed, padding themselves out with several of Mrs. Weasley's hand-knitted sweaters and carrying cloaks, scarves and gloves, Ron's shock had subsided, and he had decided that Harry's new spell was highly amusing. So amusing, in fact, that he lost no time in regaling Hermione with the story as they sat down for breakfast. And then there was another flash of light, and I landed on the bed again, grinned Ron, helping himself to sausages. Hermione had not cracked a smile during this anecdote, and now turned an expression of wintry disapproval upon Harry. "Was this spell, by any chance, another one from that potion book of yours?" she asked. Harry frowned at her. "Always jump to the worst conclusion, don't you? Was it?" "Well, yeah, it was, but so what?"
So you just decided to try out an unknown, handwritten incantation and see what would happen?
What does it matter if it's handwritten? Said Harry, preferring not to answer the rest of the question.
Because it's probably not Ministry of Magic approved, said Hermione. And also, she added, as Harry and Ron rolled their eyes, because I'm starting to think this prince character was a bit dodgy.
Both Harry and Ron shouted her down at once.
It was a laugh,
said Ron, upending a ketchup bottle over his sausages.
Just a laugh, Hermione, that's all.
Dangling people upside down by the ankle, said Hermione. Who puts their time and energy into making up spells like that?
Fred and George, said Ron, shrugging. It's their kind of thing. And,
my dad, said Harry. He had only just remembered.
What?
Said Ron and Hermione together.
My dad used this spell, said Harry. Lupin told me.
This last part was not true. In fact, Harry had seen his father use the spell on Snape, but he had never told Ron and Hermione about that particular excursion into the pensive. Now, however, a wonderful possibility occurred to him. Could the half-blood prince possibly be?
"Maybe your dad did use it, Harry," said Hermione, "but he's not the only one. We've seen a whole bunch of people use it, in case you've forgotten, dangling people in the air, making them float along, asleep, helpless."
Harry stared at her. With a sinking feeling, he too remembered the behaviour of the Death Eaters at the Quidditch World Cup. Ron came to his aid.
"That was different," he said robustly. "They were abusing it. Harry and his dad were just having a laugh."
"You don't like the prince, Hermione," he added, pointing a sausage at her sternly,
"because he's better than you at potions." "It's got nothing to do with that," said Hermione, her cheeks reddening. "I just think it's very irresponsible to start performing spells when you don't even know what they're for. And stop talking about the prince as if it's his title. I bet it's just a stupid nickname, and it doesn't seem as though he was a very nice person to me."
"I don't see where you get that from," said Harry heatedly. "If he'd been a budding Death Eater, he wouldn't have been boasting about being half-blood, would he?"
Even as he said it, Harry remembered that his father had been pure-blood. But he pushed the thought out of his mind. He would worry about that later.
"The Death Eaters can't all be pure-blood. There aren't enough pure-blood wizards left," said Hermione stubbornly. "I expect most of them are half-bloods pretending to be pure. It's only muggle-borns they hate. They'd be quite happy to let you and Ron join up."
"There's no way they'd let me be a Death Eater," said Ron indignantly, a bit of sausage flying off the fork he was now brandishing at Hermione and hitting Ernie Macmillan on the head. "My whole family are blood traitors. That's as bad as muggle-borns to Death Eaters."
"And they'd love to have me," said Harry sarcastically. "We'd be best pals if they didn't keep trying to do me in."
This made Ron laugh. Even Hermione gave a grudging smile. And the distraction arrived in the shape of Ginny.
"Hey, Harry, I'm supposed to give you this."
It was a scroll of parchment with Harry's name written upon it in familiar, thin, slanting writing.
"Thanks, Ginny. It's Dumbledore's next lesson," Harry told Ron and Hermione, pulling open the parchment and quickly reading its contents. "Monday evening." He felt suddenly light and happy. "Want to join us in Hogsmeade, Ginny?" he asked.
"I'm going with Dean. Might see you there," she replied, waving at them as she left.
Filch was standing at the oak front doors, as usual, checking off the names of people who had permission to go into Hogsmeade. The process took even longer than normal, as Filch was triple-checking everybody with his secrecy sensor.
"What does it matter if we're smuggling dark stuff out?" demanded Ron, eyeing the long, thin secrecy sensor with apprehension. "Surely you ought to be checking what we bring back in."
His cheek earned him a few extra jabs with the sensor, and he was still wincing as they stepped out into the wind and sleet. The walk into Hogsmeade was not enjoyable. Harry wrapped his scarf over his lower face. The exposed part soon felt both raw and numb. The road to the village was full of students, bent double against the bitter wind. More than once, Harry wondered whether they might not have had a better time in the warm common room. And when they finally reached Hogsmeade and saw that Zonko's joke shop had been boarded up, Harry took it as confirmation that this trip was not destined to be fun. Ron pointed with a thickly gloved hand towards Honeydukes, which was mercifully open. And Harry and Hermione staggered in his wake into the crowded shop.
"Thank God!" shivered Ron, as they were enveloped by warm, toffee-scented air. "Let's stay here all afternoon."
"Harry, me boy!"
said a booming voice from behind them. "No," muttered Harry. The three of them turned to see Professor Slughorn, who was wearing an enormous furry hat and overcoat with matching fur collar, clutching a large bag of crystallized pineapple, and occupying at least a quarter of the shop.
"Harry, that's three of my little suppers you've missed now," said Slughorn, poking him genially in the chest. "It won't do, my boy. I'm determined to have you. Miss Granger loves them, don't you?"
"Yes," said Hermione helplessly. "They're really—"
"So why don't you come along, Harry?"
demanded Slughorn.
"Well, I've had Quidditch practice, Professor," said Harry, who had indeed been scheduling practices every time Slughorn had sent him a little violet-ribbon-adorned invitation. This strategy meant that Ron was not left out, and they usually had a laugh with Ginny, imagining Hermione shut up with McLagan and Zabini.
"Well, I certainly expect you to win your first match after all this hard work," said Slughorn. "But a little recreation never hurt anybody. Now, how about Monday night? You can't possibly want to practice in this weather."
"I can't, Professor. I've got an appointment with Professor Dumbledore that evening."
"Unlucky again!" cried Slughorn dramatically. "Ah, well, you can't evade me forever, Harry!"
And with a regal wave he waddled out of the shop, taking as little notice of Ron as though he had been a display of cockroach cluster.
"I can't believe you wriggled out of another one," said Hermione, shaking her head.
"They're not that bad, you know. They're even quite fun sometimes."
But then she caught sight of Ron's expression.
"Oh, look, they've got deluxe sugar quills. Those would last hours."
Glad that Hermione had changed the subject, Harry showed much more interest in the new extra-large sugar quills than he would normally have done. But Ron continued to look moody and merely shrugged when Hermione asked him where he wanted to go next.
"Let's go to the Three Broomsticks," said Harry. "It'll be warm."
They bundled their scarves back over their faces and left the sweet shop. The bitter wind was like knives on their faces after the sugary warmth of honeydukes. The street was not very busy. Nobody was lingering to chat, just hurrying towards their destinations. The exceptions were two men a little ahead of them, standing just outside the Three Broomsticks. One was very tall and thin. Squinting through his rain-washed glasses, Harry recognised the barman who worked in the other Hogsmeade pub, the Hog's Head. As Harry, Ron and Hermione drew closer, the barman drew his cloak more tightly around his neck and walked away, leaving the shorter man to fumble with something in his arms. They were barely feet from him when Harry realised who the man was.
"Mundungus!"
The squat, bandy-legged man with long, straggly ginger hair jumped and dropped an ancient suitcase which burst open, releasing what looked like the entire contents of a junk shop window.
"Oh, hello, Harry,"
said Mundungus Fletcher, with a most unconvincing stab at airiness.
"Well, don't let me keep you."
And he began scrabbling on the ground to retrieve the contents of his suitcase with every appearance of a man eager to be gone.
"Are you selling this stuff?"
asked Harry, watching Mundungus grabbing an assortment of grubby-looking objects from the ground.
"Oh, well, got a scraper living," said Mundungus. "Give me that."
Ron had stooped down and picked up something silver.
"Hang on," Ron said slowly. "This looks familiar."
"Thank you,"
said Mundungus, snatching the goblet out of Ron's hand and stuffing it back into the case.
"Well, I'll see you all—" "Ouch!"
Harry had pinned Mundungus against the wall of the pub by the throat. Holding him fast with one hand, he pulled out his wand.
"Harry!" squealed Hermione.
"You took that from Sirius's house," said Harry, who was almost nose to nose with Mundungus and was breathing in an unpleasant smell of old tobacco and spirits. "That had the Black family crest on it."
"I—" "No.
What?"
spluttered Mundungus, who was turning slowly purple.
"What did you do? Go back the night he died and strip the place?"
snarled Harry.
No! Give it to me!"
"Harry, you mustn't!"
shrieked Hermione, as Mundungus started to turn blue.
There was a bang, and Harry felt his hands fly off Mundungus's throat. Gasping and spluttering, Mundungus seized his fallen case, then, crack, he disapparated. Harry swore at the top of his voice, spinning on the spot to see where Mundungus had gone.
"Come back, you thieving!"
"There's no point, Harry." Tonks had appeared out of nowhere, her mousy hair wet with sleet. "Mundungus will probably be in London by now. There's no point yelling."
"He's nicked Sirius's stuff. Nicked it!"
"Yes, but still," said Tonks, who seemed perfectly untroubled by this piece of information, "you should get out of the cold." She watched them through the door of the Three Broomsticks. The moment he was inside, Harry burst out,
"He was nicking Sirius's stuff!"
"I know, Harry, but please don't shout. People are staring," whispered Hermione. "Go and sit down. I'll get you a drink." Harry was still fuming when Hermione returned to their table a few minutes later, holding three bottles of butterbeer.
"Can't the Order control Mundungus?" Harry demanded of the other two in a furious whisper. "Can't they at least stop him stealing everything that's not fixed down when he's at headquarters?"
"Shh," said Hermione, desperately looking around to make sure nobody was listening. There were a couple of warlocks sitting close by who were staring at Harry with great interest, and Zabini was lolling against a pillar not far away.
"Harry, I'd be annoyed too. I know it's your things he's stealing."
Harry gagged on his butterbeer. He had momentarily forgotten that he owned Number 12 Grim Old Place.
"Yeah, it's my stuff," he said. "No wonder he wasn't pleased to see me. Well, I'm going to tell Dumbledore what's going on. He's the only one who scares Mundungus."
"Good idea," whispered Hermione, clearly pleased that Harry was calming down. "Ron, what are you staring at?"
"Nothing,"
said Ron, hastily looking away from the bar. But Harry knew he was trying to catch the eye of the curvy and attractive barmaid, Madame Rosmerta, for whom he had long nursed a soft spot. "I expect nothing's in the back getting more fire whiskey," said Hermione waspishly. Ron ignored this jibe, sipping his drink in what he evidently considered to be a dignified silence. Harry was thinking about Sirius, and how he had hated those silver goblets anyway. Hermione drummed her fingers on the table, her eyes flickering between Ron and the bar. The moment Harry drained the last drops in his bottle, she said, "Shall we call it a day and go back to school, then?" The other two nodded. It had not been a fun trip, and the weather was getting worse the longer they stayed. Once again they drew their cloaks tightly around them, rearranged their scarves, pulled on their gloves, then followed Katie Bell and a friend out of the pub and back up the high street. Harry's thoughts strayed to Ginny as they trudged up the road to Hogwarts through the frozen slush. They had not met up with her, undoubtedly, thought Harry, because she and Dean were cosily closeted in Madame Puddifoot's tea shop, that haunt of happy couples. Scowling, he bowed his head against the swirling sleet and trudged on. It was a little while before Harry became aware that the voices of Katie Bell and her friend, which were being carried back to him on the wind, had become shriller and louder. Harry squinted at their indistinct figures. The two girls were having an argument about something Katie was holding in her hand.
"It's nothing to do with you, Leanne,"
Harry heard Katie say. They rounded a corner in the lane, sleet coming thick and fast, blurring Harry's glasses. Just as he raised a gloved hand to wipe them, Leanne made to grab hold of the package Katie was holding. Katie tugged it back, and the package fell to the ground. At once, Katie rose into the air, not as Ron had done, suspended comically by the ankle, but gracefully, her arms outstretched as though she were about to fly. Yet there was something wrong, something eerie. Her hair was whipped around her by the fierce wind, but her eyes were closed and her face was quite empty of expression.
Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Leanne had all halted in their tracks, watching. Then, 6 feet above the ground, Katie let out a terrible scream. Her eyes flew open, but whatever she could see, or whatever she was feeling, was clearly causing her terrible anguish. She screamed and screamed. Leanne started to scream too, and seized Katie's ankles, trying to tug her back to the ground. Harry, Ron, and Hermione rushed forwards to help, but even as they grabbed Katie's legs, she fell on top of them. Harry and Ron managed to catch her, but she was writhing so much they could hardly hold her. Instead, they lowered her to the ground, where she thrashed and screamed, apparently unable to recognize any of them. Harry looked around. The landscape seemed deserted. "Stay there!" he shouted at the others over the howling wind. "I'm going for help!" He began to sprint towards the school. He had never seen anyone behave as Katie had just done, and could not think what had caused it. He hurtled round a bend in the lane and collided with what seemed to be an enormous bear on its hind legs. "Hagrid!" he panted, disentangling himself from the hedgerow into which he had fallen.
"Harry?"
said Hagrid, who had sleet trapped in his eyebrows and beard, and was wearing his great shaggy beaver-skin coat.
"Just been visiting Grawp! He's coming on so well you wouldn't—"
"Hagrid, someone's hurt back there, or cursed, or something."
"What?"
said Hagrid, bending lower to hear what Harry was saying over the raging wind.
"Someone's been cursed!"
bellowed Harry.
"Cursed? Who's been cursed? Not Ron? Hermione?"
"No, it's not them. It's Katie Bell. This way!" Together they ran back along the lane. It took them no time to find the little group of people around Katie, who was still writhing and screaming on the ground. Ron, Hermione, and Leanne were all trying to quieten her.
"Get back!" shouted Hagrid. "Let me see her!"
"Something's happened to her!"
sobbed Leanne.
"I don't know what!"
Hagrid stared at Katie for a second, then, without a word, bent down, scooped her into his arms, and ran off towards the castle with her. Within seconds, Katie's piercing screams had died away, and the only sound was the roar of the wind. Hermione hurried over to Katie's wailing friend and put an arm around her. "It's Leanne, isn't it?" The girl nodded.
"Did it just happen all of a sudden, or—"
"It was when that package tore,"
sobbed Leanne, pointing at the now sodden brown paper package on the ground, which had split open to reveal a greenish glitter. Ron bent down, his hand outstretched, but Harry seized his arm and pulled him back.
"Don't touch it!"
He crouched down. An ornate opal necklace was visible, poking out of the paper.
"I've seen that before," said Harry, staring at the thing. "It was on display in Borgin and Burke's ages ago. The label said it was cursed. Katie must have touched it."
He looked up at Leanne, who had started to shake uncontrollably.
"How did Katie get hold of this?"
"Well, that's why we were arguing. She came back from the bathroom in the Three Broomsticks holding it. Said it was a surprise for somebody at Hogwarts, and she had to deliver it. She looked all funny when she said it. Oh, no, I bet she'd been imperiused, and I didn't realise."
Leanne shook with renewed sobs. Hermione patted her shoulder gently.
"She didn't say who'd given it to her, Leanne?"
"No, she wouldn't tell me. And I said she was being stupid and not to take it up to school, but she just wouldn't listen. And then I tried to grab it from her, and—"
Leanne let out a wail of despair. "We'd better get up to school," said Hermione, her arms still around Leanne. "We'll be able to find out how she is. Come on." Harry hesitated for a moment, then pulled his scarf from around his face and, ignoring Ron's gasp, carefully covered the necklace in it and picked it up. "We'll need to show this to Madame Pomfrey," he said. As they followed Hermione and Leanne up the road, Harry was thinking furiously. They had just entered the grounds when he spoke, unable to keep his thoughts to himself any longer. "Malfoy knows about this necklace. It was in a case at Borgin and Burke's 4 years ago. I saw him having a good look at it while I was hiding from him and his dad. This is what he was buying that day when we followed him. He remembered it, and he went back for it."
I don't know, Harry, said Ron hesitantly.
Loads of people go to Borgin and Burke's, and didn't that girl say Katie got it in the girls' bathroom?
She said she came back from the bathroom with it. She didn't necessarily get it in the bathroom itself.
McGonagall, said Ron warningly.
Harry looked up. Sure enough, Professor McGonagall was hurrying down the stone steps through swirling sleet to meet them.
"Hagrid says you four saw what happened to Katie Bell. Upstairs to my office at once, please. What's that you're holding, Potter?"
"It's the thing she touched," said Harry.
"Good Lord!" said Professor McGonagall, looking alarmed as she took the necklace from Harry.
"No, no, Filch, they're with me,"
she added hastily, as Filch came shuffling eagerly across the entrance hall, holding his secrecy sensor aloft.
"Take this necklace to Professor Snape at once, but be sure not to touch it. Keep it wrapped in the scarf."
Harry and the others followed Professor McGonagall upstairs and into her office. The sleet-spattered windows were rattling in their frames, and the room was chilly despite the fire crackling in the grate. Professor McGonagall closed the door and swept round her desk to face Harry, Ron, Hermione, and the still-sobbing Leanne.
"Well," she said sharply, "what happened?"
Haltingly, and with many pauses while she attempted to control her crying, Leanne told Professor McGonagall how Katie had gone to the bathroom in the Three Broomsticks and returned holding the unmarked package, how Katie had seemed a little odd, and how they had argued about the advisability of agreeing to deliver unknown objects, the argument culminating in the tussle over the parcel, which tore open. At this point, Leanne was so overcome there was no getting another word out of her.
"All right," said Professor McGonagall, not unkindly. "Go up to the hospital wing, please, Leanne, and get Madame Pumphrey to give you something for shock."
When she had left the room, Professor McGonagall turned back to Harry, Ron, and Hermione.
"What happened when Katie touched the necklace?"
"She rose up in the air," said Harry, before either Ron or Hermione could speak,
"and then began to scream and collapsed.
Professor, can I see Professor Dumbledore, please?"
"The headmaster is away until Monday, Potter," said Professor McGonagall, looking surprised.
"Away?" Harry repeated angrily.
"Yes, Potter, away," said Professor McGonagall tartly. "But anything you have to say about this horrible business can be said to me, I'm sure."
For a split second, Harry hesitated. Professor McGonagall did not invite confidences. Dumbledore, though in many ways more intimidating, still seemed less likely to scorn a theory, however wild. This was a life-and-death matter, though, and no moment to worry about being laughed at.
"I think Draco Malfoy gave Katie that necklace, Professor."
On one side of him, Ron rubbed his nose in apparent embarrassment. On the other, Hermione shuffled her feet as though quite keen to put a bit of distance between herself and Harry.
"That is a very serious accusation, Potter," said Professor McGonagall after a shocked pause. "Do you have any proof?"
"No," said Harry, "but—"
And he told her about following Malfoy to Borgin and Burke's and the conversation they had overheard between him and Borgin. When he had finished speaking, Professor McGonagall looked slightly confused.
"Malfoy took something to Borgin and Burke's for repair?"
"No, Professor. He just wanted Borgin to tell him how to mend something. He didn't have it with him. But that's not the point. The thing is that he bought something at the same time, and I think it was that necklace."
"You saw Malfoy leaving the shop with a similar package?"
No, Professor. He told Borgin to keep it in the shop for him.
But Harry, Hermione interrupted, Borgin asked him if he wanted to take it with him, and Malfoy said no.
Because he didn't want to touch it, obviously, said Harry angrily.
What he actually said was, how would I look carrying that down the street? Said Hermione.
Well, you would look a bit of a prat carrying a necklace, interjected Ron.
Ron, said Hermione despairingly, it would be all wrapped up, so he wouldn't have to touch it, and quite easy to hide inside a cloak, so nobody would see it. I think whatever he reserved at Borgin and Burke's was noisy or bulky, something he knew would draw attention to him if he carried it down the street. And in any case, she pressed on loudly before Harry could interrupt, I asked Borgin about the necklace. Don't you remember? When I went in to try and find out what Malfoy had asked him to keep, I saw it there, and Borgin just told me the price. He didn't say it was already sold or anything.
Well, you were being really obvious. He realised what you were up to within about 5 seconds. Of course he wasn't going to tell you. Anyway, Malfoy could have sent off for it since.
That's enough, said Professor McGonagall, as Hermione opened her mouth to retort, looking furious. Potter, I appreciate you telling me this, but we cannot point the finger of blame at Mr. Malfoy purely because he visited the shop where this necklace might have been purchased. The same is probably true of hundreds of people.
That's what I said, muttered Ron.
And in any case, we have put stringent security measures in place this year. I do not believe that necklace can possibly have entered this school without our knowledge. But,
and what is more, said Professor McGonagall with an air of awful finality,
Mr. Malfoy was not in Hogsmeade today.
Harry gaped at her, deflating.
How do you know, Professor? Because he was doing detention with me. He has now failed to complete his transfiguration homework twice in a row. So, thank you for telling me your suspicions, Potter, she said as she marched past them. But I need to go up to the hospital wing now to check on Katie Bell. Good day to you all.
She held open her office door. They had no choice but to file past her without another word. Harry was angry with the other two for siding with McGonagall. Nevertheless, he felt compelled to join in once they started discussing what had happened.
So who do you reckon Katie was supposed to give the necklace to?
Asked Ron, as they climbed the stairs to the common room.
Goodness only knows, said Hermione, but whoever it was has had a narrow escape. No one could have opened that package without touching the necklace.
It could have been meant for loads of people, said Harry. Dumbledore? The Death Eaters would love to get rid of him. He must be one of their top targets. Or Slughorn? Dumbledore reckons Voldemort really wanted him, and they can't be pleased that he's sided with Dumbledore.
Or you, said Hermione, looking troubled.
Couldn't have been, said Harry. Or Katie would have just turned round in the lane and given it to me, wouldn't she? I was behind her all the way out of the Three Broomsticks. It would have made much more sense to deliver the parcel outside Hogwarts, what with Filch searching everyone who goes in and out.
I wonder why Malfoy told her to take it into the castle. Harry, Malfoy wasn't in Hogsmeade, said Hermione, actually stamping her foot in frustration.
He must have used an accomplice then, said Harry. Crabbe or Goyle or,
come to think of it, another Death Eater. He'll have loads better cronies than Crabbe and Goyle now he's joined up.
Ron and Hermione exchanged looks that plainly said there's no point arguing with him.
Dillygrout, said Hermione firmly as they reached the fat lady.
The portrait swung open to admit them to the common room. It was quite full and smelled of damp clothing. Many people seemed to have returned from Hogsmeade early because of the bad weather. There was no buzz of fear or speculation, however. Clearly the news of Katie's fate had not yet spread.
It wasn't a very slick attack, really, when you stop and think about it, said Ron, casually turfing a first year out of one of the good armchairs by the fire so that he could sit down. The curse didn't even make it into the castle. Not what you'd call foolproof.
You're right, said Hermione, prodding Ron out of the chair with her foot and offering it to the first year again. It wasn't very well thought out at all.
But since when has Malfoy been one of the world's great thinkers? Asked Harry.
Neither Ron nor Hermione answered him.
Chapter 13. The Secret Riddle. Katie was removed to St. Mungo's Hospital for magical maladies and injuries the following day, by which time the news that she had been cursed had spread all over the school, though the details were confused and nobody other than Harry, Ron, Hermione and Leanne seemed to know that Katie herself had not been the intended target.
"Oh, and Malfoy knows, of course," said Harry to Ron and Hermione, who continued their new policy of feigning deafness whenever Harry mentioned his "Malfoy is a Death Eater" theory.
Harry had wondered whether Dumbledore would return from wherever he had been in time for Monday night's lesson, but having had no word to the contrary, he presented himself outside Dumbledore's office at 8 o'clock, knocked, and was told to enter. There sat Dumbledore, looking unusually tired. His hand was as black and burned as ever, but he smiled when he gestured to Harry to sit down. The Pensieve was sitting on the desk again, casting silvery specks of light over the ceiling.
"You have had a busy time while I have been away," Dumbledore said. "I believe you witnessed Katie's accident."
"Yes, sir. How is she?"
"Still very unwell.
Although she was relatively lucky, she appears to have brushed the necklace with the smallest possible amount of skin. There was a tiny hole in her glove. Had she put it on, had she even held it in her ungloved hand, she would have died, perhaps instantly. Luckily, Professor Snape was able to do enough to prevent a rapid spread of the curse."
"Why him?" asked Harry quickly. "Why not Madame Pomfrey?"
"Impertinent," said a soft voice from one of the portraits on the wall, and Phineas Nigellus Black, Sirius's great-great-grandfather, raised his head from his arms, where he had appeared to be sleeping. "I would not have permitted a student to question the way Hogwarts operated in my day."
"Yes, thank you, Phineas," said Dumbledore quellingly.
"Professor Snape knows much more about the dark arts than Madame Pomfrey, Harry. Anyway, the St. Mungo's staff are sending me hourly reports, and I am hopeful that Katie will make a full recovery in time."
"Where were you this weekend, sir?" Harry asked, disregarding a strong feeling that he might be pushing his luck, a feeling apparently shared by Phineas Nigellus, who hissed softly.
"I would rather not say just now," said Dumbledore. "However, I shall tell you in due course."
"You will?" said Harry, startled.
"Yes, I expect so," said Dumbledore, withdrawing a fresh bottle of silver memories from inside his robes and uncorking it with a prod of his wand.
"Sir," said Harry tentatively, "I met Mundungus in Hogsmeade."
"Ah, yes, I am already aware that Mundungus has been treating your inheritance with light-fingered contempt," said Dumbledore, frowning a little. "He has gone to ground since you accosted him outside the Three Broomsticks. I rather think he dreads facing me. However, rest assured that he will not be making away with any more of Sirius's old possessions."
"That mangy old half-blood has been stealing black heirlooms," said Phineas Nigellus, incensed,
and he stalked out of his frame, undoubtedly to visit his portrait in No. 12 Grimold Place.
"Professor," said Harry after a short pause, "did Professor McGonagall tell you what I told her after Katie got hurt? About Draco Malfoy?"
"She told me of your suspicions, yes," said Dumbledore.
"And do you...
I shall take all appropriate measures to investigate anyone who might have had a hand in Katie's accident," said Dumbledore. "But what concerns me now, Harry, is our lesson." Harry felt slightly resentful at this. If their lessons were so very important, why had there been such a long gap between the first and second? However, he said no more about Draco Malfoy, but watched as Dumbledore poured the fresh memories into the pensieve and began swirling the stone basin once more between his long-fingered hands. "You will remember, I am sure, that we left the tale of Lord Voldemort's beginnings at the point where the handsome muggle, Tom Riddle, had abandoned his witch-wife Merope and returned to his family home in Little Hangleton. Merope was left alone in London, expecting the baby who would one day become Lord Voldemort." "How do you know she was in London, sir?" "Because of the evidence of one Caractacus Burke," said Dumbledore, "who, by an odd coincidence, helped found the very shop whence came the necklace we have just been discussing." He swilled the contents of the pensieve as Harry had seen him swill them before, much as a gold prospector sifts for gold. Up out of the swirling silvery mass rose a little old man, revolving slowly in the pensieve, silver as a ghost, but much more solid, with a thatch of hair that completely covered his eyes.
"Yes, we acquired it in curious circumstances. It was brought in by a young witch just before Christmas, oh, many years ago now. She said she needed the gold badly. Well, that much was obvious. Covered in rags and pretty far along. Going to have a baby, see? She said the locket had been Slytherin's. Well, we hear that sort of story all the time. Oh, this was Merlin's. This was his favourite teapot. But when I looked at it, it had his mark all right, and a few simple spells were enough to tell me the truth. Of course, that made it near enough priceless. She didn't seem to have any idea how much it was worth. Happy to get 10 galleons for it. Best bargain we ever made."
Dumbledore gave the pensieve an extra vigorous shake, and Caractacus Burke descended back into the swirling mass of memory whence he had come.
"He only gave her 10 galleons, said Harry indignantly.
"Caractacus Burke was not famed for his generosity," said Dumbledore. "So we know that, near the end of her pregnancy, Merope was alone in London, and in desperate need of gold, desperate enough to sell her one and only valuable possession, the locket that was one of Marvolo's treasured family heirlooms."
"But she could do magic," said Harry impatiently. "She could have got food and everything for herself by magic, couldn't she?"
"Ah," said Dumbledore, "perhaps she could, but it is my belief, I am guessing again, but I am sure I am right, that when her husband abandoned her, Merope stopped using magic. I do not think that she wanted to be a witch any longer. Of course, it is also possible that her unrequited love and the attendant despair sapped her of her powers. That can happen. In any case, as you were about to see, Merope refused to raise her wand even to save her own life. She wouldn't even stay alive for her son." Dumbledore raised his eyebrows. "Could you possibly be feeling sorry for Lord Voldemort?"
"No," said Harry quickly. "But she had a choice, didn't she? Not like my mother."
"Your mother had a choice too," said Dumbledore gently. "Yes, Merope Riddle chose death in spite of a son who needed her. But do not judge her too harshly, Harry. She was greatly weakened by long suffering, and she never had your mother's courage. And now, if you will stand..." "Where are we going?" Harry asked as Dumbledore joined him at the front of the desk. "This time," said Dumbledore, "we are going to enter my memory. I think you will find it both rich in detail and satisfyingly accurate.
After you, Harry.
Harry bent over the pensive. His face broke the cool surface of the memory, and then he was falling through darkness again. Seconds later, his feet hit firm ground. He opened his eyes and found that he and Dumbledore were standing in a bustling, old-fashioned London street.
"There I am," said Dumbledore brightly, pointing ahead of them to a tall figure crossing the road in front of a horse-drawn milk cart.
This younger Albus Dumbledore's long hair and beard were auburn. Having reached their side of the street, he strode off along the pavement, drawing many curious glances due to the flamboyantly cut suit of plum velvet that he was wearing.
"Nice suit, sir," said Harry before he could stop himself,
but Dumbledore merely chuckled as they followed his younger self a short distance, finally passing through a set of iron gates into a bare courtyard that fronted a rather grim, square building surrounded by high railings. He mounted the few steps leading to the front door and knocked once. After a moment or two, the door was opened by a scruffy girl wearing an apron.
"Good afternoon. I have an appointment with a Mrs. Cole, who I believe is the matron here."
"Oh," said the bewildered-looking girl, taking in Dumbledore's eccentric appearance.
"Just a mo. Mrs. Cole!" she bellowed over her shoulder.
Harry heard a distant voice shouting something in response. The girl turned back to Dumbledore.
"Come in. She's on her way."
Dumbledore stepped into a hallway tiled in black and white. The whole place was shabby but spotlessly clean. Harry and the older Dumbledore followed. Before the front door had closed behind them, a skinny, harassed-looking woman came scurrying towards them. She had a sharp-featured face that appeared more anxious than unkind, and she was talking over her shoulder to another aproned helper as she walked towards Dumbledore.
"And take the iodine upstairs to Martha. Billy Stubbs has been picking his scabs, and Eric Wally's oozing all over his sheets. Chicken pox on top of everything else," she said to nobody in particular.
And then her eyes fell upon Dumbledore, and she stopped dead in her tracks, looking as astonished as if a giraffe had just crossed her threshold.
"Good afternoon," said Dumbledore, holding out his hand.
Mrs. Cole simply gaped.
"My name is Albus Dumbledore. I sent you a letter requesting an appointment, and you very kindly invited me here today."
Mrs. Cole blinked. Apparently deciding that Dumbledore was not a hallucination, she said feebly,
"Oh, yes. Well then, you'd better come into my room. Yes."
She led Dumbledore into a small room that seemed part sitting room, part office. It was as shabby as the hallway, and the furniture was old and mismatched. She invited Dumbledore to sit on a rickety chair and seated herself behind a cluttered desk, eyeing him nervously.
"I am here, as I told you in my letter, to discuss Tom Riddle and arrangements for his future," said Dumbledore. "Are you family?" asked Mrs. Cole. "No, I am a teacher," said Dumbledore. "I have come to offer Tom a place at my school."
"What school's this, then?"
"It is called Hogwarts," said Dumbledore.
"And how come you're interested in Tom?"
"We believe he has qualities we are looking for."
"You mean he's won a scholarship? How can he have done? He's never been entered for one."
"Well, his name has been down for our school since birth."
"Who registered him? His parents?"
There was no doubt that Mrs. Cole was an inconveniently sharp woman. Apparently Dumbledore thought so too, for Harry now saw him slip his wand out of the pocket of his velvet suit, at the same time picking up a piece of perfectly blank paper from Mrs. Cole's desktop.
"Here," said Dumbledore, waving his wand once as he passed her the piece of paper. "I think this will make everything clear."
Mrs. Cole's eyes slid out of focus and back again as she gazed intently at the blank paper for a moment.
"That seems perfectly in order," she said placidly, handing it back.
Then her eyes fell upon a bottle of gin and two glasses that had certainly not been present a few seconds before.
"May I offer you a glass of gin?" she said in an extra refined voice. "Thank you very much," said Dumbledore, beaming.
It soon became clear that Mrs. Cole was no novice when it came to gin drinking. Pouring both of them a generous measure, she drained her own glass in one. Smacking her lips frankly, she smiled at Dumbledore for the first time, and he didn't hesitate to press his advantage.
"I was wondering whether you could tell me anything of Tom Riddle's history. I think he was born here in the orphanage."
"That's right," said Mrs. Cole, helping herself to more gin. "I remember it clear as anything, because I'd just started here myself. New Year's Eve, and bitter cold, snowing, you know, nasty night. And this girl, not much older than I was myself at the time, came staggering up the front steps. Well, she wasn't the first. We took her in, and she had the baby within the hour. And she was dead in another hour."
Mrs. Cole nodded impressively and took another generous gulp of gin.
"Did she say anything before she died?" asked Dumbledore. "Anything about the boy's father, for instance?" "Now, as it happens, she did," said Mrs. Cole, who seemed to be rather enjoying herself now, with the gin in her hand and an eager audience for her story. "I remember she said to me, 'I hope he looks like his papa.' And I won't lie, she was right to hope it, because she was no beauty. And then she told me he was to be named Tom for his father, and Marvolo for her father. Yes, I know, funny name, isn't it? We wonder whether she came from a circus. And she said the boy's surname was to be Riddle. And she died soon after that without another word. Well, we named him just as she'd said. It seemed so important to the poor girl, but no Tom nor Marvolo nor any kind of Riddle ever came looking for him, nor any family at all. So he stayed in the orphanage, and he's been here ever since."
Mrs. Cole helped herself, almost absent-mindedly, to another healthy measure of gin. Two pink spots had appeared high on her cheekbones. Then she said,
"He's a funny boy."
"Yes," said Dumbledore, "I thought he might be.
He was a funny baby, too. He hardly ever cried, you know. And then, when he got a little older, he was odd."
"Odd? In what way?" asked Dumbledore gently.
"Well, he..."
But Mrs. Cole pulled up short, and there was nothing blurry or vague about the inquisitorial glance she shot Dumbledore over her gin glass.
"He's definitely got a place at your school, you say?"
"Definitely," said Dumbledore.
"And nothing I say can change that?"
"Nothing," said Dumbledore.
"You'll be taking him away, whatever?"
"Whatever," repeated Dumbledore gravely. She squinted at him as though deciding whether or not to trust him. Apparently she decided she could, because she said in a sudden rush,
"He scares the other children."
"You mean he is a bully?" asked Dumbledore.
"I think he must be,"
said Mrs. Cole, frowning slightly.
"But it's very hard to catch him at it. There have been incidents. Nasty things."
Dumbledore did not press her, though Harry could tell that he was interested. She took yet another gulp of gin, and her rosy cheeks grew rosier still.
"Billy Stubbs' rabbit? Well, Tom said he didn't do it, and I don't see how he could have done. But even so, it didn't hang itself from the rafters, did it?"
"I shouldn't think so, no," said Dumbledore quietly.
"But I'm jiggered if I know how he got up there to do it."
"All I know is he and Billy had argued the day before. And then..." Mrs. Cole took another swig of gin, slopping a little over her chin this time.
"On the summer outing, we take them out, you know, once a year, to the countryside or the seaside. Well, Amy Benson and Dennis Bishop, were never quite right afterwards, and all we ever got out of them was that they'd gone into a cave with Tom Riddle. He swore they'd just gone exploring, but something happened in there, I'm sure of it. And, well, there have been a lot of things. Funny things.
She looked at Dumbledore again, and though her cheeks were flushed, her gaze was steady.
I don't think many people will be sorry to see the back of him.
You understand, I'm sure, that we will not be keeping him permanently, said Dumbledore. He will have to return here, at the very least, every summer.
Oh, well, that's better than a whack on the nose with a rusty poker, said Mrs. Cole with a slight hiccup.
She got to her feet, and Harry was impressed to see that she was quite steady, even though two-thirds of the gin was now gone.
I suppose you'd like to see him.
Very much, said Dumbledore, rising too. She led him out of her office and up the stone stairs, calling out instructions and admonitions to helpers and children as she passed. The orphans, Harry saw, were all wearing the same kind of greyish tunic. They looked reasonably well cared for, but there was no denying that this was a grim place in which to grow up.
"Here we are,"
said Mrs. Cole as they turned off the second landing and stopped outside the first door in a long corridor. She knocked twice and entered.
"Tom, you've got a visitor. This is Mr. Dumbarton. Dunderbore. He's come to tell you—well, I'll let him do it."